Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, family identity, rites of passage, helicopter moms. Have you ever heard of the Tiger Mom? I'm pretty sure Violet Baumgartner could give her a run for her money. Violet is a relentlessly well-intentioned bulldozer of a woman whom you might find in your church congregation or your school committee. And writer Gretchen Anthony has put her at the center of a story that will test Violet's rather smug image of herself. Doubt how annoying Violet can be? One glance at her holiday letters, replete with self-congratulatory and falsely modest news about her husband and daughter's accomplishments, and you'll know just what I'm talking about. Gretchen Anthony's new novel is titled Evergreen Tidings from the Baumgartners, and she joins me in the studio. Welcome. Great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Are you offended or agreeing about my comparison between Violet, your lead character, and the Tiger Mom?
I am in wholehearted agreement.
Does it fit?
It fits. It fits. I think every culture has, you know, the Tiger Mom stereotypically comes out of Asian cultures,
right.
But I think every culture has a mom that just is driven by a need to give their children everything that they can.
I said helicopter mom. She's that and more.
She's
right?
That and a PR agent wrapped up in one.
Public relations, something you know something about,
something
right?
I do.
Right? So the line here is, am I creating a character that the reader would want to live with through 350 pages? And I found I needed a bit of a boost to get over that barrier.
Yeah, I can understand that. I did... As I took it through, I'm in a number of writers' groups, and I used to watch the reaction of people as they were reading her. And one reader in particular, we used to laugh because he would literally have a physical reaction to her. It's almost as if she made his skin itch.
Interesting that it's a he.
It is.
That a man
yes.
had that kind of reaction.
I did too.
Right?
I did too. And by nature, he's extraordinarily laid back. So I think, you know, I recognize that she's going to. Every reader is going to react to her differently. And I recognized that I had to be very careful to humanize her.
Right.
Yeah.
And also not make her, I mean, we're going to talk about writing with humor here in a bit, but also not to make her a caricature and yet
right.
humorous enough that it lightened a lot of the personality traits that are universal enough that I think she drives us crazy. Like, I know people that have elements of Violet,
yes.
right?
Yeah.
So
I think actually most of the readers that I've talked to related to her on some level. And I think that's why people tend to enjoy the book, because she's relatable. They feel that there's a little bit of Violet in either themselves or someone that they know. And yet she's just far enough out there where she doesn't feel like she's in your life. Thankfully, it's easy to say when people read Violet, they say she was so much like my mother-in-law or so much like my mother. But thankfully, my mother was not that bad.
Right. So when you were developing her in the writers groups, I mean,
yeah,
were you
at the loft
all in a deeper way with her personality and you found yourself dialing back, or were you changing key parts of her character? In reaction to what you were hearing?
I was dialing her back and humanizing her at key points. And my editor was critical in helping me find those points, too, where we really needed to turn her human light on. She is a character, though, I knew growing up. She's not... she's not any one person in particular, but I grew up with so many Violets that she has lived with me quite literally since I was growing up in my parents' house. So I know her instinctively, and I had to find a way to dial her back from that caricature limit and still make her human enough and yet make her big enough, larger,
right.
just larger than life, so that there was humor and a bit of levity in her in the long run.
You know, I think it's an interesting experience with, and maybe this is a debut novel, right?
Yes.
You've done a lot of writing in your career.
Yes,
but
a lot.
not published novel writing. I think it's an interesting experience to go through the writer's group gauntlet, right? Mm-hmm. As you're developing a first-time novel, and know what to take from that, and know when the advice of your fellow writers and readers is, I don't know, missing the mark, or it's covering over your own voice enough that, you know, you feel like you have to get out from under that?
Yeah. Yeah. I think every reader, or every writer, rather, has to go through a growth process that is taking feedback. And thankfully, because I had worked as a writer throughout so much of my career, I had already developed, some people call it a thick skin. I wouldn't necessarily characterize it as that, but I had developed my sensors. You know, I grew to know my writing capabilities just enough so that when I transitioned into fiction, even though it was an entirely new experience, I already had a foundation where there were elements where I could say, all right, yeah, I can take that. I can take that feedback, and or I can let that go. If it continue, you know, the thing about feedback though is that if it continues to come up, then it's probably got some merit behind it, and you need to start listening. Writers are really at their core listeners more than communicators. You know, we take in most of what I'm doing 90% of the day is taking in the world around me, yeah. And it, eventually that's going to find itself on the page.
I think there's also value in the reader being able to see a bit of the working it out and uncertainty and self-doubt that comes in the first time you're working this out on the page. And some polisher, you know, if there's too much polish to that, mm-hmm. I feel like we lose that. That's part of the value of that authenticity that I think you were talking about.
Yeah, and I would argue that being authentic is being less than polished.
Yeah.
When I talk about, I got a lot of questions because there are so many Christmas letters throughout this book. I got a lot of questions about writing Christmas letters this year. And
good,
I always,
we're going to talk about that. Yeah.
I always said you should put the good and the bad in there because life isn't about perfection. You don't go through 365 days a year without worry or without a care. And that makes us human.
You're listening to an interview with writer Gretchen Anthony, debut novel. It's called Evergreen Tidings from the Baumgartners, and she's with me in the studio. One of the ways that we get to know Violet Baumgartner is through these Christmas letters, and they're not chronological.
No.
Good way to go on that. They're scattered throughout the novel, and we're learning bits and pieces of her life and her personality and how incredibly necessary there is for a comeuppance in her life, right?
Yes.
Aren't we getting that strong sense through these Chris? Man, this woman needs to take a fall and learn something. But
she does take a fall.
Saying that? I know she does. Yes, in more ways than one. You know, as I was reading the Christmas letters, I don't get hardly any of them anymore. And I was thinking, it's almost as if Facebook and Instagram have stepped in. You've thought about this.
Yeah.
Like how social media has stepped in with a constant Christmas letter approach.
Yeah.
What's going on with that?
I actually put out an entirely non-scientific question out onto social media this fall asking who still sent Christmas cards or Christmas letters and why. And I was not prepared for how many people came back to me and said that they didn't do that anymore because they felt like they put so much on Facebook that or social media in general that everybody who they wanted to know about their life already knew everything about their life. And I don't know why I wasn't prepared for that question or for that response, but it really did surprise me. And then I took some time to think about it because on the surface it made sense. Well, of course, you're already sharing throughout the year in a more immediate time frame what you want people to know. But then I realized, you know, there's been so much focus, particularly on Facebook and the algorithms lately. I don't, even for my closest friends, I don't see everything that they post online. It all depends on how many people have liked it and how big of news it is. And so the algorithms, number one, are shaping what we see. And unless I live on Facebook 100% of my day, I'm not going to catch everything that way. And while I'm on social media an awful lot. I still see a lot of value in it, and I really hope that we can figure out a way to fix it, because I think there's a lot of danger in it too.
I mean, the other thing that I think the thing that I was most interested in, though, is this version of self.
Right?
I mean, that's what the letters do, and that's what we're wrestling with on social media, the version of yourself that you're putting forth with all the implications of that.
That is human. I don't think the Christmas letter was any different. I saw it was either in the New York Times or the Washington Post. There was an article this fall about that called the Christmas letter the original social media post. Because it's human to want to put our best face forward.
See, there's something about the Christmas letter, though, that seems so homespun and harmless. But, I mean, there was a time with all the stuff that we worry about with social media and the version of ourselves we put forward. It wasn't all that harmless.
No. And that's where this book originally came from. That's where I met the Violets in my life. I happened to grow up. My father was a pastor. And so we had a huge community.
I could have guessed that.
Could you have?
Yes. Lutheran?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, I do.
Scandinavian? Yes.
Oh, but I'm half German.
Okay, got it. That makes all the difference. Okay, your dad was a pastor.
And so every year we would receive, 100 Christmas cards and letters, and from friends and congregation, and everybody. When you move around like a pastor, you gather gather a pretty large community,
right?
But I early on started to recognize that there was a subset of these letters that were, I considered them gems. Maybe it was the budding writer in me, but they always stood apart. And eventually, my dad and I would take these few gems that we would get every year, and we would sit in the family room and we'd do dramatic readings of them because the Violets of the world were really entertaining. If you didn't look at them with a bitter heart and you actually, decided to find some joy in this over the top, lavish picture that they were creating of the world and sending to you in the Christmas letter. It was great fun. And I tell that story at book readings. And originally, I used to feel bad about it. And you wouldn't believe how many people have come up to me and said that they do exactly the same thing. One woman told me that that's become their Christmas Eve ritual, because they all bring letters and they do dramatic readings of them.
Do you think the writers of the Christmas letter that were chosen to be given the dramatic reading, how would they have felt about knowing that the pastor and his daughter were sitting around good fun? I assume it was not mean mockery, but
Yeah, absolutely.
What do you think they would have thought of that?
Probably wouldn't have liked it.
I like to think of the pastor as transgressing the
Well, anyone who knew my dad knew he had a pretty wicked sense of humor. So,
yeah. There is something about being I grew up in a Lutheran church, too. Most of them were small. There were a lot of politics. My parents were involved in the running of the church. I bet you were aware early on of how political your dad's work was.
Yeah. I was extremely aware of it early on, because you can't leave that. There's something about the church that's particularly personal as well. Mm-hmm. You can't necessarily leave that. I mean, it didn't help that we lived across the street from the church. So people, were literally coming to our door because they couldn't find parking. But I was aware of that early on. And then over time, I've learned to recognize that I think, the more resource constrained an organization is, the less money you have and the less opportunity that you have, then power and influence becomes your largest commodity. Mm-hmm. And so places like nonprofits and organizations, of course, they're going to be even probably possibly more political than an organization that's flush with multiple resources.
I mean, do you mean that there were people in the congregation who had the means who had outsized influence because of that?
Yeah, or tried to exercise it, whether or not they won their influence that they sought. Yeah. Yeah, you bring your influence where you can.
What do you remember about your dad writing sermons?
That they always happened in the middle of the night. Yeah.
With the writing of the sermon?
Oh, absolutely.
So what do you remember about that?
I had the bedroom right on the other side of my dad's study. They wouldn't start until after dark. And I also remember he listened to Lake Hammond every Saturday night. So there would be jazz going, and Dad typed on a typewriter for years after the computer came. And I remember him just working and listening to jazz and falling asleep to that. Yeah, in the dark.
I wonder if some of your, I haven't asked you about what your writing habits are like, but I wonder if some of your, I don't know, writing ethic was developed through that. What do you think?
I don't think my writing ethic, I think I have the anti-writing ethic that was shaped through that. I'm too high strung to put it off until that late at night. However, that was my dad's. He was a night owl. That was his golden hour. And so I did notice from my very earliest memories that writing comes from the soul. I mean, it is a part of a person, this urge to write. It is core to who a person is. And I think I was raised in a house that valued creative expression. And I feel extraordinarily blessed for that. I grew up in a family that lived through laughter and creative expression, valued education. My mother raised just a family full of characters, and she just let everybody be who she was. I mean, I had this father who was just wildly he was just wildly scattered and big personality, and there was nothing he loved more than a good story, especially if he could steal it and tell it as his own. And then my mom, you know, and then there was my older brother, who was just the typical oldest child who did everything right. And then there was me, who was the typical middle child who just tried to bust through boundaries. But we were both pastor's kids, and I just hated all the eyes on me. But then a certain part of me probably loved it. And then
because there's some amount of performance to that, right?
Yes, absolutely.
They're watching me.
And I took advantage of it. I promise you, I'm not so unself-aware that I don't know that I did that. And then we had a Down syndrome youngest sister. So, I mean, just a crazy house. And bless my mom's heart. I mean, I look at that now and I think, wow, that was a gold mine for me, you know, as a writer, because there's so much that I can pluck from my past. And yet at the heart of all that was laughter and love. I mean, I really grew up in a great situation for where it has taken me in my life.
Doesn't your writer's note say something about the idea for the Christmas letter came from a Christmas letter that your dad wrote about your mother's can opener? What's the story?
He used to, well, my parents didn't get Christmas letters out every year, but when they did, my dad used to always emphasize the mundane because, you know, in one year he started
That's clever.
A Christmas letter by saying the highlight of Annie's year, my mom, was getting a new can opener. she said, "Paul, that was the highlight of my year." You know, a formative moment for me, because I remember him saying, "Of course it wasn't the highlight of your year, but everybody's going to come at us with Christmas letters with all these wonderful flowery things, and ours is going to be different. People are going to remember it because I talked about your can opener."
Your dad knew counter programming long before it was a thing, right?
Yes,
he really understood it. Okay, I'd like you to read an excerpt from the novel. And it's the very first Christmas letter that Violet writes. It's the year 1978?
Eight.
Six? Eight. Okay.
Yeah.
Set it up just a little bit about where she is at this point.
This is the very, I love that you asked me to read this one, because this is actually one of my favorite Christmas letters.
Good.
I think it's the very first one that she writes after getting married. And so it's the, and she this is the very first Christmas letter she writes, period. And I think it is so descriptive of the way she sees her role in the world. Christmas 1978. Dearest loved ones far and near, evergreen tidings from the Baumgartners. It brings me such joy to sit down at the typewriter tonight. As if the thrill of becoming Mrs. Edward Baumgartner weren't enough, I'm now able to join in the most revered of traditions, the family Christmas letter. I look forward to sharing our Baumgartner news with you as the years pass, and I pray that the dear Lord will allow me to do so for a long time to come.
I like how your voice changed as you got into that. Read one more paragraph in that Violet voice.
Now, on to news of the wedding. Our deepest thanks to each and every one of you who joined the celebration. I really can't believe it's over. It felt so long in coming, and then, suddenly, it was gone. Over in the bat of an eye. For the briefest moment in time, we were happier than we'd ever imagined.
What is that violet voice? How would you describe that as you listen to yourself do it?
Everything that Violet does, she does to perfection. And I don't, you know, she, as a character, I think she's so fearful of doing something wrong that fear drives her in everything she does. And so I almost can't help but put that voice on because it's flowery, it's over the top, it's perfect. You know, she has her hair done. And she has her clothes pressed, and life is under control.
Gretchen Anthony reading from her new novel, debut novel, called Evergreen Tidings from the Baumgartners. This is a good point on the restraint that she not only applies to herself and her home, but what happens when she kind of tries to apply it to the orbit, the people in the orbit around her, and I mean beyond her family. I think the response to that is kind of a mix of, you can bet people talk about her behind her back.
Oh, absolutely.
I think we get a little glimpse of that. But there's also a kind of surprising amount of compassion and appreciation for her, nonetheless.
Yes.
How? Why?
Why the compassion?
Yeah.
Because Violet actually is driven by goodwill.
Ah.
Yeah.
And so people recognize that.
I think people recognize it. There's a character in the book who recognizes and says as much to Violet and becomes a turning point for Violet, recognizes just how much she does to give back to her community, which is mostly her church, but then her church is a conduit to the community around it. And she's extraordinarily involved. And this character recognizes how much she put into raising her daughter, and the character is also raising a young daughter and says, I really respect how much work you put into it, and if my child turned out to be half the woman your daughter has become, I would feel immensely proud of that.
Go ahead. What were you going to add?
Well, it's really interesting because I think particularly as women and particularly as Midwesterners, Minnesotans, we are so discouraged from promoting ourselves and for talking about our accomplishments that it almost becomes this neurosis that like Violet has, that if we do it, we have to portray ourselves as so perfect and so over the top that then people don't really, they have a hard time taking it seriously.
So you put that at Midwestern more than, I think women struggle with this.
I
don't care
so
where you grew up, right? Yeah. And how your personality has developed.
Yeah.
There is still that voice in the back of your head that says, hold it back, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I had a moment today where I thought, why is my book on Carrie Miller?
And then you answered yourself.
Because people love my book.
Well done, Gretchen. Excellent. We're learning. I want to talk about parenting here for a minute because I felt pretty ambivalent about Violet's daughter's character.
Oh, yeah.
Lover, dynamic, ambitious, thoughtful, compassionate, well-centered, remarkably well-centered after being raised in a household with Violet.
Yes.
And I couldn't decide whether I believed that or not.
Yes.
So I want to know how you thought about who this daughter would be.
Cerise.
Right.
Yeah. Her daughter's name is Cerise. Yeah, I thought a lot about Cerise. And in defining her character, I looked at a lot of people that I knew who had been raised by mini Violets.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I know of anyone who's come out quite as successfully with full-blown Violet. But the way I landed on Cerise is that she really is her father's daughter. And I think that Violet and her husband, Ed, work because they're it sounds cliche to say that opposites attract, but they're so one-sided as individuals that it's almost as if they pour into each other's buckets to make a whole person. Violet is so externally facing and so in need of helping her family achieve. And Ed is so internally facing and so accomplished and successful mm-hmm. that it's as if she is able to exercise all of her accomplishment needs through him and then in turn her daughter. You know, the other thing that Violet or that Cerise does as a daughter, though, is, and I took this from my growing up, is that smart girls in particular, they know exactly how to work the edges of their parents. You know, they know.
What do you mean by that?
They know where the lines are. You just they can toe right up to the line and figure out what they're going to get away with and then turn a corner and, you know, and come back and work the situation to their own advantage. And Cerise is very smart, and she's her father's daughter, and she learned early on that the best way to manage her mother is to not obstruct her mother. You know,
and the other thing I reminded myself was with the comparison with the Tiger Mom is most of the children of what we think of as quintessential Tiger Moms are successful.
Yes,
and I mean they're whole people too. They're
yeah.
not little intellectual achieving machines, which always shocks me.
Right,
right. These are people that. They understand music not just for its technical capability, but also for the emotional side. You know,
yeah.
these people become fully realized humans in an environment where you think that should produce a machine.
Right. Right. Well, and you'll notice in the book, Cerise comes to very serious points of doubt. When she, you know, soon after having the baby, she wonders if it's the worst thing that she ever did, the best right. thing and the worst thing that she ever did.
That was powerful. Good for you. Because you know what the myth of motherhood is, right?
Absolutely.
It's wonderful from beginning to end.
It is. Yeah. And I felt that very strongly myself. That part of Cerise's struggle really came out of my struggle. I was so happy to have made the choice, but it changed my life dramatically. I had been so independent, and I was so independently minded and independently focused. And suddenly I was responsible for other lives, which was my choice. And I had never seen myself without having that mm-hmm. as a part of my life, motherhood as part of my life. And yet, what had I done?
Did you feel like you could talk about that?
It took a while.
I mean, either with friends and does it take a while because there's a lot of judgment
yes.
and mythology around this decision?
Yes. I felt very incomplete. Yeah. I felt very...
incomplete because you were questioning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Inferior. Yeah. Really. I felt like, what's wrong with me that I don't love giving 100% of my attention to this creature who needs it? Or... why am I not taking that extra step to ensure that I'm reading all the parenting books? Or why do I not want to email their kindergarten teacher about everything that I just saw on their initial evaluation? What am I doing wrong?
So when did you start to build confidence that you were finding your way? And if it didn't look exactly like, you know, the icon of motherhood, that was okay too.
Part of it was maturity. Part of it was finally embracing my inner, I'm very much an introvert. Part of it was realizing that that was core to who I was. Well, I shouldn't say I'm very much an introvert. I am probably half extrovert, half introvert, but I had spent my life denying my introverted needs.
Huh.
And part of it was having my third child, and suddenly life was just too busy. You have to give things up. And so between maturity and a little bit of self-realization, a lot of therapy. you know, my dad died of Parkinson's, and we had a son who was born critically ill. And those things are important to reflect on and get a handle on. And all of those components together just helped me let go of a lot more stuff.
So what you were giving up was some attention to perfection, right? Some ideal
yes.
that other people have. Was
yeah.
that it?
Yeah. I think it's Anne Lamott. She calls perfection the enemy of the people.
Yeah.
And every time I read, I think it's in Bird by Bird, because I read that, I try to refer that to that book often. It's non-productive. I remember hearing someone say once, guilt is non-productive. And that really resonated with me, because I realized in that moment how much of my energy I was spinning on all the things that I was either not doing or doing wrong. And what was that getting me? It wasn't getting me anything.
You know, there are other Western cultures where this idea of parenting, basically mother's guilt, is not accepted and really not taken in mm-hmm. by a lot of women. Mm-hmm. I don't know why this remains so powerful in the American culture.
I don't either. I mean, it's easy to chalk it up to this Ozzie and Harriet type picture that we developed out of the 50s, but we're long out of the 50s. And I think part of it, too, is that, you know, my generation of women, I was thankfully raised on free to be you and me, you know, so to speak. You mm-hmm. can do anything. Girls can do anything boys can do. And that shaped us wonderfully. But then we also went into careers and we were changing more than possibly our partners were. Although,
And the environment in which we were working
right.
was not.
Right.
I mean, super cosmetically, it seemed to be changing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the core ideas, I don't think we're changing that quickly.
Yeah. Right. Right.
I was reading a blog that you write. Was it or contribute to the Scary Mommy
yes.
blog?
Yeah.
Is your son still 14 or was this a while ago?
This was a few years ago.
Okay. So you were wrestling with how not to smother your teenage son.
Mm-hmm.
And you write, it's impossible to say be independent, but only when I say it's okay. And yet he's only 14. The line between his dependence and independence grows fainter by the day. You know what I wondered about that was if you would be wrestling with the diminishing line in the same way if he wasn't a boy, if he was a girl.
I hope I would. I love raising boys. I love having my pack because...
Do you have three boys?
I have three boys.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I have thought about what it would be like to have a girl. And of course, I can't speak from that perspective, but I was raised by parents who probably treated me differently than because I was a girl, but gave me an awful lot of independence when I compared that to my friends. And I don't recall them saying ever once, girls don't do that, or quantifying it by my gender. So I really hope I would. But I'm not blind to the fact that there's inherent bias. I'm not blind to it at all in how we parent and just how we treat any child that we have influence over in our lives.
What's the thing you now understand about parenting that you wouldn't have known as your kids entered their teens? Because that's the challenging years the most, isn't it? 12 to, I don't know, what, 17, 18, 32, I don't know.
Yeah, you know, my experience has not proven that that's the most challenging.
So when was the most challenging?
The most challenging was birth to about 5.
So what's the thing you learned that you didn't know? About those years.
That it's, what I'm really thankful that we taught them, and I think I taught this to them originally by accident, was that it's really important to take the time that you need to be alone or to not be overstimulated.
Wow.
Yeah. Our oldest son, just by default, because he was born so prematurely, had these overstimulation. He had hypersensitivity issues when it came to stimulation.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, through his occupational therapy and physical therapy, learned when he was feeling overstimulated and can withdraw himself now and regroup. And I mean, he never had behavioral or outburst issues, anything like that. But he can feel it when his head is scrambling. And so now that's just sort of and that's around the time I started to recognize that I needed that as an introvert. I needed mm-hmm. my quiet time to regroup. And the thing I think I've learned about parenting is that it's okay not to control everything. which is, you know, I am a bit type A. So that was a learning
You're a little
experience.
Bit violet.
I'm
like.
A little
Are
bit
you?
Violet. I think everybody's got a little bit of violet in them. Yeah. Yeah. As much as painful as it may be, Carrie, to recognize your inner violet, I think she might be there.
Gretchen, thank you. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Gretchen Anthony's new novel is called Evergreen Tidings from the Baumgartners. You can read about it on The Thread.